Hey everybody, it's Mark. Thanks for joining me today. Today is episode 5 of my podcast, Charles Gassenheimer's Lies. But before we get to it, I have to flex a little bit. My UConn Huskies from Storrs won the national championship last night in men's basketball. The women, unfortunately, lost in the semifinals. And on top of that, they covered each of the 6 games that it takes to win the national championship. So I'm sitting here having won 6 nights in a row and feeling good about the local team. And on top of that, I've mentioned that I'm the chapter advisor of my college fraternity at the UConn campus. And so I'm right now involved with a group of boys who are really excited and really bringing the energy over this UConn victory. So congratulations to the UConn Huskies. This is episode 5. This is the last episode where we will get to hear from Charles Gassenheimer in his own words. We're going to go all the way to the end. I want to share a couple of things, though, before I do that. One is that I'm going to be posting the original podcast that I recorded with Charles Gassenheimer, unedited and uninterrupted, because I have had a number of people ask me for that. It is a really interesting listen, even if you've heard all previous, including this one, all 5 episodes. It's nice to hear it without my interruptions and without my commentary as well. I'd like to think that my commentary added something to it the first time, but one time through, it's really interesting just to see just how consistently and over the entire period of time without interruption, this guy just brings an enormous amount of bullshit. In addition to that, I do plan one last episode, episode 6 of this series of the Charles Gassenheimer's Lies series, although we'll be done with Charles at that point. It'll just be me and you in the final episode, though I suspect that Gassenheimer is going to keep lying. In that 6th episode, I'm going to share some of my final perspectives on the series and the events of Kelly Moore and what is going on with Gassenheimer and Flax, in my opinion. I'm also planning on answering in episode 6 a couple of questions that I've gotten. The most consistent, the one that I know for sure I'm going to get to, is why did I do this? And so in episode 6, I'm going to give a more detailed explanation than I put on any of these episodes or in my blog. Regarding why I undertook this podcast series, which is a departure from sort of my normal reporting. I also am going to spend a little time in that episode talking about what comes next in my Kelly Moore coverage, because as you heard, I am going to be leaving Charles Gassenheimer here and just sort of let my words on him speak for itself. But this all started not as an opportunity to tell the Charles Gassenheimer story. If you remember, this was really me telling the Kelly Moore story and the events of Kelly Moore, the paint company. As it happens, Charles Gassenheimer had this prominent role. And so I felt like I needed to spend some time there. But I do want to get back and do some sort of more traditional coverage of the news of Kelly Moore. And so let me tell you what I've got planned. I do plan 2 more miniseries before I give up the Kelly Moore coverage completely. The first one I want to talk about is actually the second one that you're going to see, and that's with the people of Kelly Moore. I've had a number of people reach out. I've spoken to, I wouldn't even know, several hundred, I suspect. The story of what happened to Kelly Moore has affected all of those people very differently. And it's the story of those people, those Kelly Moore employees, that I'm looking to tell. You know, it's interesting to me, some of the people that I've spoken to in the aftermath of this event, there were employees at Kelly Moore who never thought for a second that they'd have to make a resume, 20, 30 plus year employees of the company, that never thought that they were going to be going anywhere else. In addition to that, there are a lot of Kelly Moore employees that I'm speaking with who had personal experience dealing with Charles Gassenheimer, and they have stories that they want to tell as well as just sort of the human side of this. What were some of the outcomes of this? How are people finding work? How did they find that experience? And so I think there's several really interesting stories among the Kelly Moore people that I'm talking to right now. I am hoping that 3 or 4 of them raise their hands and say that they're willing to talk to me while recording. And so if you're one of those people, if you think that you have an interesting perspective on the events of Kelly Moore and you're willing to share what this experience has been like for you as a Kelly Moore employee, and you're looking to share that, maybe help some of your other employees understand some of their feelings and some of what they've gone through, maybe help do some healing, reach out to me. Pan, go ahead and put my cell phone number up there. Shoot me a text. talking. There's no obligation. If you want to just get on the phone and talk about it and you decide that it's not for you, you know, no harm, no foul. But I would love to get three or four of you on a podcast episode and really start telling the story of how this impacted paint people, because this obviously, this event, the closing of Kelly Moore, had an enormous impact on the lives of 1,200 employees of the company. And so that I'm looking at maybe doing three or four episodes, perhaps preferably one, but maybe as many as two people per episode. So as many as four, five, six of you who want to tell your story, reach out and we'll see where this goes. But before you see that, and currently that's just a work in progress, so it's untitled. But before you see that, you will see another mini series from me. This one's called The Opportunists, and that's going to be with three or four companies who jumped right into the chaos of the Kelly Moore event and used the opportunity of that chaos to transform their businesses significantly. I've written about some of these companies, and some of these companies have taken very bold actions in this event. These stories, in my opinion, are among the most compelling that I've heard in my time in the paint business, that these executives saw this opportunity and what it took to muster the resources, rally the staff in such a way, and to come up with the vision and the execution in such a way that in 30 days and 60 days, they completely transformed their business with next to no forethought. Nobody knew that this company, that Kelly Moore, was going to go out of business. But I think you're going to hear from one of the companies, actually, that maybe they did have a little heads up. But for the most part, nobody knew. And they just sort of sprang into action. And four companies that I'm aware of, and I'm currently looking to sign, I've got agreements from two of them to participate. I'm looking to sign the other two. And so I think that that will be among the most compelling content that comes out of this, because the stories from these executives and what they've been able to accomplish are really fascinating. They're case studies in business response and certainly crisis response. And so that's all coming in episode six. Let's get to the last words from the liar in chief, Charles Gassenheimer. Where did we end up the last time? If you recalled, in episode four, just at the end, he was promising every independent paint retailer who was in a one-day drive of Hearst, Texas, access to unlimited supplies of paint. Okay, where were we?
Supportive of others. We're opening up in South Florida. We already have warehouse space there. Flax just happens to own warehouse space in Miami. So we think we can go into Florida in a big way. We're looking to partner with others in the Florida market as well. And so I think what you'll see from us is we don't have, this is a white piece of paper for us, right? We don't have some limitation or preconceived notion of what we need to do. And so that flexibility gives us the ability to have multiple conversations. We're already pretty big in the export market into the Caribbean. And I think you'll see us continue that. And I think that's something we can use Miami for a launching off point for, right? And so as we build out the new business plan, the new Kelly Moore, what it looks like, I think what you'll find from us is a tremendous amount of flexibility around understanding what it is that you, the customer, need, and being able to give you that responsiveness rather than saying, here's a 100-page deal agreement, sign it, or basically go away. We don't want you.
Insulting again. He can't resist it. It's his arrogance that comes through so much to me as I'm watching this again. And again, to remind you, other than the first few minutes, I've only saw this a year ago when it was originally recorded. I watched the first few minutes when this whole thing first broke. And otherwise, this is all virgin territory to me, in that I don't remember the details of the conversation. But I'm overwhelmed just sitting here. And I think I'm starting to see it on my face at this point in the recording. I'm overwhelmed by his arrogance.
Business. I'm not directing that at anyone in particular, but I'm trying to just give people the comfort and understanding that for us, it's about having that conversation on what is it that you need to be successful, because we think we can provide it in a very different way.
He said, I'm not directing that at anyone. A minute ago, I wanted to hear the whole sentence before I commented, but he was directing that at one. He was directing that at one. He was specifically commenting to the relationship between Benjamin Moore and his and their retailers. And for some reason, this guy had the desire to comment several times, you know, over the course of the episode. So really, just at this point, I can tell you for sure, because I know how I'm sitting here feeling now. For sure, I can tell you I would have been, you know, insulted by this point, or at least wondering, what is this guy up to talking about, you know, what to me would be sort of insulting characterizations of some of the relationships that I've had.
And so tell me, the independent retailers that you're hoping to reach are somewhere between, you know, 75 to 85% of their volume goes out to professional painters, depending on, you know, the stores and the mix and the owner. But it's generally speaking in that range. How do you reach that consumer and support the idea of putting effectively an unnamed product, you know, outside of that California area where I do know you guys are very strong, but outside of that, you know, portion of the country where you guys are strong, how do you get painters and other consumers to be willing to use your products?
Yeah, so look, I mean, it's interesting, right? I think there's a couple of answers to that question, right? I think the first answer is as you think about the different opportunities that we have, right? So one, for example, one retailer, we're looking at a store within a store concept. And so there we would put our people into the store and educate the consumer and take the responsibility of doing that, right? And so that could be one idea where we are responsible for the education. In another example, right, if there's a retailer, an independent retailer that's got a trusted brand and name already in the market, we can provide additional marketing dollars to them to get the word out. Look, the one thing I can tell you, and again, because I'm fresh and new to the paint business, I've had to do the work to talk to the voice of the customer and really understand. And the one consistent feedback that I get about Kelly Moore that's different from others is, one, our people make the difference, right? When they come into the stores, our people are incredibly knowledgeable. They know how to understand the customer need and they know how to fill it. And when they come in the store, they can grab a cup of coffee and some donuts and we'll load the paint in their truck and they'll be on their way. And so
let me speak to that, because I so often on this podcast speak to Charles Gassenheimer's lies, but in this case, I have an opportunity to say that here in this particular case, Chucky Boy is speaking the truth. And that, you know, at this point, I've had interactions with, I don't know, countless former employees of Kelly Moore over the phone, Zooms, texting, back and forth, DMs, countless interactions. And in my experience so far, yeah, y'all are a really terrific group of people to be getting to know. I've enjoyed it very much. The family feeling that you guys talk about, it definitely seems to exist. And you seem to have been a talented group of people, because I see other manufacturers and other retailers grabbing you guys and opening stores with you guys. And so there, finally, Charles spoke a little truth.
So I'd love to replicate that with everybody.
Right.
But again, I have to meet the customer where the customer wants to be met. But the other thing, the other answer to answer your question is, when you roll Kelly Moore paint on the wall, you can see the difference almost instantaneously. And so what I have to do and what we have to do.
Charles Gassenheimer just told a lie right there, right? Because paint just doesn't work that way. And I'm not going to bore the paint people with why it doesn't work that way and how we know by trying to describe for the listeners who maybe don't have as much experience with paint to know, but just take it from me. This guy's fucking lying right here, right? There's rolling Kelly Moore paint on the wall is like rolling Benjamin Moore paint on the wall, like Rolling Sherwin Williams paint on the wall. And there are definitely different characteristics. I'm not saying that every paint is the same. Obviously, I'm aware that there are a wide range of characteristics of different types of paints that might feel differently, but none of that is relevant to the statement that he just made. Kelly Moore paint in that way is not a different experience in such a way that will entice the market to flock to it, as he's implying.
Is get our product out in the market and say, give us a shot. You know, we'll give you that lifetime guarantee on our product. We'll demonstrate to you that from a quality.
He wasn't planning on sticking around for very long. So a lifetime guarantee from a guy like this is not worth a whole heck of a lot.
Perspective. We are the David in an industry of Goliaths. We definitely understand that. But we understand that when you put up our paint on the wall, it is just a phenomenally good experience. And so we have to get our paint out there and get people trying it, because literally once they try it once, we believe they'll be converted.
You know, I think that's going to be one of your challenges. We talked about this a little bit in the prep. I think that's going to be one of your challenges. In a lot of the country, professional painters are very attached to the brands that they use. Many of them Sherwin-Williams, many of them Benjamin yes. Moore. But they are, whoever is their chosen brand, they're in some parts of the country, it's Kelly Moore, but whatever is their chosen brand, they're very attached to them. And so I think that that's going to be a challenge for you guys. I'm curious to see how that plays out. I certainly think you can do it, but I think that that's going to be a very challenging, portion of this project to undertake.
I don't disagree. And just to be clear, we respect, all our competitors' products. Sherwin in particular is the 800-pound gorilla for sure.
Yeah.
And Ben Moore is not to be underestimated, right?
That's certainly but, not if you're interested in playing in this space.
Right.
You know, listen, they are the 800-pound gorilla in this category anyway.
No question. So I think, you know, the way to answer that question, right, is, you know, from my perspective, is we don't want to be 19 billion, at least not today, right? We want to stay nimble, and the amount of market share capture that we need to capture to achieve our financial goals is so small relative to the overall industry that I'm really not worried about the whole country. And that's not our goal.
Right.
I think we have to throw darts, and I think you're going to see us be laser focused in certain target areas that we think. And again, it's not rocket science. Our manufacturing facility is in Hearst, Texas. So clearly we want to continue to grow in the Southwest and Southeastern US, which is a one day's drive from our plant, so that we can really service those customers in a real way. And so I think that's another answer to your question, which is, look, we're not trying to, you know, while we're trying to punch a little bit over our weight class, we are not trying to compete head to head with Sherwin. We respect their market positioning. And same with Ben Moore, we respect their market positioning and what they've been able to accomplish.
And
that's
so
not
then,
to say, that's not to say that maybe one day through acquisitions, we can't do that. And I know perhaps you were going to go there, so I'll let you ask more questions. But
I'm not talking about acquisition until we pause the recording. But
okay.
But yeah, that's definitely on the agenda for today. And so,
you know, at the beginning, Charles seemed like a very serious player. As you may be able to tell from our conversation right there about prospective acquisitions, and as you may recall from earlier in the podcast series, when I was speaking about the opportunity that I had with them and the consulting opportunity and the financial opportunity, these guys were making a lot of sense when you looked at just the circumstance. Kelly Moore was a very well-known brand. They had an excellent reputation for terrific people, for terrific products, and they had a reputation as an efficient manufacturer. And so he made a comment earlier about Flax having a warehouse in Miami. And so in terms of this conversation, yeah, some of me was already thinking, you know, wow, this guy moves quickly. You know, I'm used to advising corporations and such. And you know, you could talk to somebody about where they need a warehouse for 6 months before they even turn the coffee pot on, you know, and all of a sudden these guys are really serious. And so even though now here we are, we're 20 minutes, 21 minutes into about a 24 minute recording, he's still, there's parts of him that make sense. But my feeling is this, when you're dealing with a liar, and this would apply to personal life as well, although that does get a little bit more complicated. I had an uncle growing up who was a terrible liar. He was a business partner of my father's. He was a terrible liar, meaning that he was frequently changing the truth to manipulate you. And that's basically what I feel about Charles Gassenheimer's behavior. And so how do you deal with somebody like that? Well, listen, first and foremost, in my opinion, the reason why I'm not in the pile of victims right now is because of my personal view that in business, as soon as you realize that somebody you're dealing with is a liar, you should immediately remove yourself from that circumstance. The risk will always outweigh the rewards, and I make all business decisions based on risk reward, as you should too, through some measurement, at least in some way of risk reward. And that's just a bad one, right? Because you may find out that you, in fact, don't have anything. And so my feeling was the reason why I was already thinking I needed more information to make sure that I understood what I thought I was feeling on this podcast was to get away, was to figure out quickly if that was the best decision for me in these circumstances. Was it true he was a liar? Because if it was, it wouldn't matter how much he was offering me. I wouldn't believe that he was serious about his intention of paying. And so that's come up a lot. A lot of people have asked me about that, not necessarily paint people. And so I just thought that I would throw that in there. Let's keep going.
But yeah, that's definitely on the agenda for today. And so when, getting back to our call here, when can dealers expect to see some of this in the market? You said you're going to start seeing them at trade shows, for example. Were you guys at the National Hardware Show last week?
Yes.
We had. How did that go for you?
Fantastic.
And I certainly don't want to get into a discussion about the likelihood of the National Hardware Show being fantastic for a paint manufacturer, because I like the National Hardware Show. I've gone, I don't want to start dissing it. The Hardware and Paint Association is involved with that and still supporting that show. And so I certainly don't, you know, want to say anything bad about it, except to say that the likelihood that a paint manufacturer went to it last year and had a fantastic experience, which to me means meeting lots of paint retailers and selling lots of paint, which, by the way, has proven to be a lie. So I guess I can call you that now, since we know that that didn't happen. But listen, at the time that he said that, that it sure seems like a lie to me.
You know, when I say fantastic, look, we don't have to have the biggest booth and the shiniest toy.
That's interesting, by the way, before he goes on, just to point out one thing. Remember, I told you I'm hearing this with you for the first time. As you're hearing my commentary, I haven't heard any of this in a year.
In the toy box, right? We like to have what I like to call quiet conversations. And when we have quiet conversations, business gets done. We're going to be in Orlando next week as well, at the Builders Show. Yep. So we are at all of these major events, right? But we're there in a way that, you know, is going to be more understated relative to the major players. But
weren't we talking about how he's going to meet dealers? Does he know that I know that dealers aren't at any of those shows that he mentioned?
Are there, and we're there in a big way, and we're having the types and quality of conversations that are really, I think, will lead to business, lead to revenue.
Well, there has not been, that I'm aware of, a new major manufacturer come into the independent paint retailer channel, at least in my 30 or so years there. So you guys really stand alone. You're able to blaze your own path, so to speak, if that's what you guys want to do here.
Yeah, I mean, look, hopefully the key takeaways again for me, and you know, if you're an independent retailer and you want to see an alternative, I just hope you give us a chance, right? I formally can tell you we're asking for your business. We think there's the difference with dealing with Kelly Moore, and at the end of the day, we think we can give you the flexibility and the product breadth that you need. So I would hope you'd give us a shot, but I understand that the market is certainly a competitive marketplace. But so we've got to go the extra mile to make sure that we keep you happy.
What an absolutely outstanding way to end it. Charles Gassenheimer, the new CEO of Kelly Moore, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So that's it. Now you could say whatever you want about, because something's going up there.
And so having listened to the whole thing again, he just offends in so many ways. And so I understand why I got off of this recording and felt like I needed more information. Remember at the beginning when I started telling this story, I had mentioned that when I got off of the podcast itself, I didn't feel like I wanted to run away from Charles at that time. That came probably about a week and a half later. What I felt like at that time was he had said enough, and I think you had heard enough things that I knew to be just false, like that whole bullshit about the way his paint feels on the roller. Things that I just knew to be false, or just that my bullshit detector had gone off enough times that I knew I wanted more information about what was going on at Kelly Moore and Charles Gassenheimer. Remember, I had mentioned I had a friend of mine who was speaking to me during my conversations with Kelly Moore about a contract with them. And I had a friend who I was sharing the details of that contract. And my friend was saying, you know, through that, no, I just don't see them spending that money from what we're seeing. And so here we were both involved with the same company, with the same executive team, having two totally different experiences. And so that was a red flag. That was a red flag. And so I wonder if, having seen this, now I put after this call where there was just filled with, you know, like I said, just enormous bullshit. I'm putting that together with this red flag that a friend had waved. And I started to make some more calls. I started to do some more research. And what I found was that the few people that I was involved with at Kelly Moore were the people that I was already talking to. And so they weren't going to be able to maybe share any more information than I was already getting. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, wait a minute, these vendors are all the same vendors that from the All Pro shows, from the National Hardware shows, which I did used to go to when I was working more regularly than I am now. And so it was getting in touch with them. It was getting in touch with the vendors that started to make it clear that this guy was a problem. Within days of wrapping this up, I was hearing from vendors that he was treating them unethically, not just stiffing them for the money, which is freaking bad enough, but sticking them in a way that was unethical, to try to draw them into putting up more of their credit and just mistreating them, just not a good dude to deal with, right? That's why I don't like to deal with liars. That's why I don't. That's why as soon as I find out somebody's a liar, that's just my personal policy. It's a practice of mine. And so when I started hearing that he was mistreating the vendors, and then I started looking into it a little bit further and doing some other research that, you know, you're seeing the outflow of all of that right now, and started to realize that this was not the sort of dude that I wanted to have any further dealings with. And the Corizon stuff, obviously, I became aware of. I don't know, did he not think I was going to Google that after he mentioned them? That part to me is when I speak to the arrogance or the stupidity, you know, it's one of the two. It's arrogance that drove him to stupidity, to think that he could mention something to me on the air like that, on a recording like that. And I wouldn't Google it because of why. Every person would Google that, Charles. What the fuck were you thinking? That company was already a disaster. Why were you flexing that? You had already been appointed CEO. People had already died on your watch. And you had already settled cases for wrongful death. And so, listen, when you start seeing that, you know, that he was just not the sort of guy that I wanted to deal with. I am 60 years old, 59 at the time, you know, relatively recently retired, relatively happy with the stability that retirement gives me. You guys who know me for a long time, you see the smile on my face. My friends who are watching this, you know how really chill my life has become. I'm recording this at 2 in the afternoon. I got a joint going. And so why did I want to mess with that? And so I backed away real quick. You guys heard that, read that story in the blog. You can go back and read it if you didn't. And I blew them off real quick, and I buried two podcasts, this one and another one that I had recorded with my friend Gus Giannopoulos, who was going to be a distributor. He had been working with Kelly Moore for several years, and he became a victim, unfortunately, as well, of Charles Gassenheimer's lies. That's where we ended up, is just a very quick end to the whole thing. I buried the two podcasts, and I never thought that I was going to do much with this. I actually have another really interesting podcast that I found in you know, sort of a buried pile. This is one of 10 or 20. I wouldn't even know, you know, how many podcasts that I made that I never released. When you make podcasts, they're a bit like mistints, you know. You make enough paint, of course, you're going to spill some, and podcasts are no different. I wasn't going to do anything with that until this whole thing exploded onto the scene, and he blew Kelly Moore up for no reason. He put those 1,200 wonderful people out of work and made their lives unstable for no reason. He screwed $50 million somewhere in there, is my opinion, of vendors for no reason. Kelly Moore had the money to pay that. That's the Texas two-step. If it turned out that Charles Gassenheimer and the Flax Group had to bankrupt Kelly Moore because of the asbestos or something else, and they had gone into the bankruptcy court and said, listen, here's all the money. We can't save it. You guys work it out. Well, that's what bankruptcy court is for, right? But that's not what happened here, and that's not the Texas two-step.